WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
Tom. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Several national politicians have called for conversations on race. Charlotte Mecklenburg School Superintendent Heath Morrison says he'd like to have a conversation on race. Well, today we're going to have one with someone who says he's not an expert on race, but he is among the most prominent anti-racist writers and activists in the country. He's also been called one of the most brilliant, articulate, and courageous critics of white privilege in the nation. I'm talking about Tim Wise, author of White Like Me, Reflections on Race from a Privileged Son, and Affirmative Action, Racial Preference in Black and White. Welcome to the program. Welcome to Charlotte.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Mr. Wise is in town for several events organized by Trinity Episcopal School and Mecklenburg Ministries, and Reverend Dr. Rodney Sadler is a board member of Mecklenburg Ministries, associate pastor of Mount Carmel Baptist Church, and assistant professor of Bible at Union Presbyterian Seminary, I would presume. Nice to have you here as well.
It's good to be with you.
And Thomas Franz is headmaster at Trinity Episcopal School, where an event with Mr. Wise will take place tomorrow at 7 o'clock. Yours is the only one of, I think, four events that still has seats available, right?
That's right. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to have you here. I have to start, we were just talking off the air about having to travel around the country and talk to people on the radio and television and newspaper reporters and whatnot. And when you've been doing what Mr. Wise has been doing for as long as you've been doing it, you get asked a lot of the same questions. And he said, the first question I always get asked when I get off the airplane is, how did you get started down this path? Well, as luck would have it, Mr. Wise, that is my first question.
and of course, when I joked about it, I was rolling my eyes too.
So that's exactly right.
Yeah, right.
So how did you start down this path?
Yes. Well, you know, the answer is a long one. I'll try to do the short, or relatively short version. I mean, I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. I've lived in the South all my life. I was born to, you know, civil rights minded parents, not activists. They were a little too young to have been actively involved in the movement, but were always supportive of the movement from sort of the outskirts of it. And so I was raised in a particular context. And I think, like a lot of white folks from the South, you know, white folks from the South are this sort of special breed of people in the sense that when it comes to race, you know, we either really don't get it or we really do, because we're forced to confront the issue of race in ways that I think a lot of white folks other than from the South, often don't, you know. And so growing up during desegregation in Nashville, around the same time that deseg was happening in Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, Davidson County, Nashville, Tennessee schools, same thing. Busing begins about 71 at the high school level, gets down to elementary school by 74, which is the year that I start. And, you know, I had this very well-integrated school setting where, you know, the vast majority of my close peers were black kids. I actually went to Tennessee State University for preschool. So in the earliest formation of my peer group, you know, I was used to not being the norm. And it was a really deliberate thing that my mom did by putting me at TSU, which is a historically black college, for those who don't know. Being in that preschool program, having black women as the primary educators, so the authority figures early on in my life outside of my own family were African-American women. The peers were black kids. And so what I think that did, I'm somewhat speculating, but I think probably on point with this, is that once I started elementary school and going through lower and middle school grades in the mid-70s, the fact that I had that peer group meant that when those kids were as they were, and as still happens all around the country, treated very differently by teachers when they were tracked into the lower level track classes, even though they were just as bright as I was, but the perception was that they were not. So they were given a very different, and I would say inferior, curriculum compared to those of us who were white. When they were disciplined more harshly than those of us who were white, even though we all broke the same rules, we all goofed off, we all talked back to the teacher, we all, you know, did the same things, but the black kids would get sent to the office or suspended or paddled, because of course corporal punishment was and still is legal in most of the southern states, Tennessee being one of them. And but the white kids would not. I would see that because, unlike most of the other white kids who probably didn't know a lot of the black kids and wouldn't have paid a lot of attention to that disparity, to me it was glaringly visible because these were my friends. These were people I had a real stake in. And then also later on in my life, having been in that setting with those black authority figures early on, meant that 22, 23 years later, when I was working as a community organizer in public housing in New Orleans, where I went to school at Tulane and then stayed there as an organizer for 6 years after I graduated, and I'm working in public housing, working with black women, mostly in the community, and when they were telling me about their lives, you know, when they're telling me their experiences with economic injustice and racism and just everyday living. Because of that early experience that I had, learning to respect black authority, because that was the authority in my life, other than my own parents, I'm listening to those women in the mid-1990s, and I'm not going to be the guy who questions their authority and says, "Well, are you sure you're really experiencing that, or might you be seeing things?" Because that's unfortunately what I think a lot of times those of us who are white do when people of color talk to us about their experiences with racism. Is we think they're exaggerating, we think they're making a mountain out of a molehill. But there I was listening to these women and knowing in my gut and deep in my soul that what they were saying was not just something they said for effect. It was really their life. And I think my upbringing in those early years has a lot to do with that consciousness over time. So, you know, I said it was going to be short. It's not really. But it was a combination of upbringing and the experiences that I had from the time that I was very young all the way through college, living in New Orleans, being in an incredibly diverse city, really a black city culturally and demographically, both before and now again after Katrina, but going to a school that was Tulane, a plantation in the middle of this black city. And it was a huge contrast for me, which, you know, just happened to expose me to a lot of the inequities that I think otherwise, you know, would have been very easy for me to miss.
And I would imagine it exposed you a lot to people who didn't get it.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think what was stunning to me, you know, was going there, and I mean, I didn't get it either, you know, and I think it's dangerous for any of us to ever think that we've gotten it. We're always in a process of getting it a little more each day, if we're open to it. But I was stunned at how little most of my white peers at Tulane, particularly who were not from the South, they were from the South. Like I said, there tended to be an awareness, even if these were folks with whom I disagreed vehemently politically. If you're white and you're from the South, you can be as conservative as you want, but you know race is an issue. Like, white Southerners are not in denial about that. But white kids, like my roommate was from Chicago, and a lot of the kids at Tulane were from New York or New Jersey or Chicago, the Chicago suburbs, and they had a total lack of awareness, I think, about institutional racism. They had a complete lack of, and of course, they all thought that we in the South were the ones with the problem. So they brought that sort of mentality, but yet they were just as clueless as anyone, if not more so. So it was stunning, and luckily, I had some incredible mentors in New Orleans, most of them black folks in the community, but also some amazing white anti-racist allies who had been in the struggle for a very long time. I was exposed to some of the sort of legends of the struggle, including those whose names I had not read in history books. You know, I met many of the principal organizers from SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, people I'd read about but only sort of tangentially understood their history. And I got to meet some of those folks there in New Orleans, some of whom were doing work and some of whom were coming through in graduate school. And so it was just amazing to be exposed to a deeper understanding of race and my own role as a white man in this country, either collaborating with the injustices that had existed or doing something to resist them.
Reverend Sadler, you've been nodding your head a lot as he speaks. How rare is somebody like Tim Wise, who happens to be white, with the level of understanding that he seems to have about this issue?
I think I've been particularly impressed by Tim Wise in terms of his insight, in terms of his understanding of what's going on, and the depth of his analysis of what's going on in terms of white privilege. I think it is, unfortunately, much rarer than it should be, given the history that we all have, that we aren't more conscious of this after 400 years of American life, 400 years of dealing with issues of race. Is surprising to me, but unfortunately, it is relatively rare. Now, that's not to say that there aren't a number of really knowledgeable people who are Caucasian who engage in this type of work. But I think Tim does bring something special to the table. And maybe it's both his depth of analysis as well as his eloquence in presenting some of these issues.
So. We're going to talk a lot about white privilege, I would think, in this hour. But from your point of view as an African-American, enlighten us. How does white privilege manifest itself in ways that we can't recognize, those of us who are Caucasian?
I think white privilege is one of these ever-present issues. Thank you for the softball question there. White privilege is one of these ever-present issues that sort of it just goes by without being evident to so many people. I think that African Americans recognize it all the time. We can see the privilege, the opportunity, the advantage that people have who are white in relationship to us. For example, one of the things that always gets me is when we talk about the inner city communities, we talk about poverty, we talk about schools that are underachieving, we notice that African American and Latino students often live in these environments, but it's not a problem that they do. It's not something that we are constantly working against because they do. I think if white children far more often lived in such environments, it'd be a different matter of conversation. There'd be a different discourse going on.
Well, I read something yesterday about this with regard to violence. When things like Sandy Hook Elementary happen, yes. Things like that don't happen here. Is the comment that you hear quite frequently.
Except they do all the time.
Usually perpetrated by white males, incidentally. Yes. That shooting in all these shootings that we've had recently are white male shootings. But things like that don't happen here is a code phrase, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it's tragically dangerous to continue to repeat it. You know, many years ago, and I don't want to take credit for having thought of this before others because I'm sure there were plenty who thought of it before I did, but back in 1998 when Kip Kinkle, who some will recall was a school shooter out in Springfield, Oregon, killed his family and went to school and shot several people. This was before Columbine, which was the next year in 99. I started writing at that time pieces talking about and when I was on the road, I would talk about this sort of white blindness, not color blindness, because we see color. We see color coming a block away. But if it's white, we don't notice if there's white dysfunction or white pathology. And so here was this kid, and he wasn't the first. There had been several even before him. And no one ever talked about it as a cultural phenomena of white middle-class males the way we know they would have had these shootings been perpetrated by young black and Latino kids. And in fact, you know, what's dangerous about it is that when you have these communities, Springfield, Oregon, Paducah, Kentucky, Pearl, Mississippi, Jonesboro, Arkansas, Littleton, Colorado, Newtown, Connecticut, all these places that are, quote, nice, safe, really good places to raise kids, and people sometimes move to those places to get away from the Denvers and the San Diegos and the Portlands, and they let down their guard, frankly, to the fact that there is dysfunction and pathology where they live as well. I mean, Columbine was a perfect example of that. Here you had two kids who were threatening to kill people, you know, for months. They made a video for a grade, a class project, where they acted out in their own home movie the murder of their classmates and teachers, and they turned this in for a grade. And no one thought, wow, maybe we should, you know, do something about this. Now, if that had been one of the black kids or one of the Latino kids at Columbine, there were only about seven in the whole school. If there had been two of them walking around threatening to kill people, you know full well that there would have been a whole discourse around the danger of these people. So in a way, not only is it white privilege that the Kip Kinkles of the world and the Klebolds and Harrises of the world don't get profiled, that's clearly privilege. But the weird irony of it is it's incredibly dangerous, because then if I let down my guard to the fact that my kids are building 30 bombs in the basement or whatever they're doing, then I'm actually now in danger. So I want people to understand that talking about white privilege is not just about making white people feel bad. You know, it's about saying this is actually dangerous. There's a certain dysfunction to this truth. And in the long run, it can actually let you down as well.
Thomas Wise is the author of White Like Me, Reflections on Race from a Privileged Son. We're also with Dr. Rodney Sadler with the Mecklenburg Ministries and Mount Carmel Baptist. And I'm going to let Thomas Franz have a say here in a few minutes. He's the headmaster at Trinity Episcopal School. We have to take a break. We're coming right back with more Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and British American School of Charlotte, empowering individual achievement for students age 2 through high school, hosting an open house Thursday, January 31st, 6 to 7:30 p.m., britishschoolofcharlotte.org. And Theatre Charlotte presenting The Foreigner, a farce about a man who pretends to be a foreigner, not proficient in English, and in the process, he uncovers many secrets. January 25th through February 10th, tickets at carolinatix.org. Eating out is not really a Southern tradition, but changing times and changing demographics have resulted in growth in the amount of meals we eat in restaurants and increased the number and variety of restaurant choices. With Charlotte Restaurant Week on the horizon, we're going to explore the evolution of eating out with nationally known cookbook, author, and food writer Molly O'Neill, Helen Schwab from The Observer, and of course, Peter Reinhardt and others tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, New York lawmakers agree on tighter gun control laws. President Obama is expected to announce broad action to curb gun violence later this week. An update on federal and state gun control efforts.
That's the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
A conversation on race here on Charlotte Talks this morning on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tim Wise is with us, author and activist, has written a book called White Like Me, Reflections on Race from a Privileged Son, among others. Reverend Dr. Rodney Sadler is here, board member of Mecklenburg Ministries and pastor at Mount Carmel Baptist Church, and Thomas Franz, headmaster at Trinity Episcopal School, responsible for bringing all these elements together and sponsoring Mr. Wise at four separate appearances, one of which is tomorrow evening, Thursday evening at 7 o'clock at the school on January the 17th, 2013, in case we repeat this program later on down the road. This strikes me, Mr. Franz, as being an uncomfortable conversation for some people, particularly for white people, and a lot of the people who would attend your school, an uncomfortable conversation. Why are you sponsoring this?
Well, you know, for us as an Episcopal school, one of the things that Episcopal schools strive for is to seek equity and justice and talk about issues of social justice. And embracing diversity is a core value for our school. And we know that it is not with great ease that diversity comes. And we know there's hard conversations and awareness that needs to be made for the broader community. And really, there are four events, one of which is going to be a middle school diversity conference that Tim will be the keynote for earlier in the day. And we've brought folks in from a variety of schools really to hit the point that he mentioned earlier about instilling this in kids. And we talk about developing cultural dexterity for kids, and that's really in part by putting them together in interesting ways.
Somebody told me off the air a couple of days ago on this program that kids today don't see race. They see friends. Just because your skin is black or yellow or red or whatever it may be, they don't see that. They don't see any difference as having a redhead or a blonde or a brunette. Is that true from your experience?
I think kids will say that, but I know it's not true.
Right.
based on experience working with kids, and we do have affinity groups at Trinity, which is important. It's one of the compelling reasons why I wanted Tim to talk to our middle school students as well as those from other schools that are coming, is to make that point. And oftentimes the kids who will say we don't see race are white kids.
Right.
And so that's part of the piece for us as a school where we need to make sure the kids are aware of.
I'm not sure who to ask this question of, but is this a particularly American problem or trait, this racial barrier that we have? We see black, we see white, we see Asian, we see Hispanic, or is this worldwide?
I think there's always a sense of othering that takes place in societies. Gordon Allport talks about the notions of prejudice that are pervasive in just about every society in the world. But I think that the way that we view race here is distinct. We have a particular way of viewing race.
Is that because of our history?
I think it's definitely informed by our history, and I think it's also informed by our politics and our economics. And to leave those issues out is problematic when we talk about issues of race.
Because you have said, Mr. Franz, that you seek, at Trinity Episcopal, you seek to grow by leaning into the challenges of diversity, part of what it means to be children of the God who created such a rainbow of people. And given, I mean, I have a reverend here and I have you from Trinity Episcopal, so given the stated Christian belief that we are all God's children, why is diversity such a damn challenge?
Well, I think there's, you know, I think there's advantage that's had by certain groups, and whether it's socioeconomic or whether it's racial or ethnic, and it's hard for people who are in that privileged position to see it. And I think Tim's experience, my experience growing up in Chicago, by the way,
right.
where I was in probably isolated in certain ways, but I had certain opportunities to be experienced to people of color, and then, you know, having roommates, my roommate in college, my best friend in college are African American. So I was lucky to have experiences like Tim mm-hmm. that opened my eyes in a way that I don't think everybody has that opportunity. And so I think there certainly are people that are trying to preserve what is good for them and comfortable for them.
But the other side of that coin is I went to T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria, which mm-hmm. is immortalized in the film Remember the Titans, which mm-hmm. I don't remember anything about. and I was there then. And my best friend in high school was a guy named Bill Yule, an African-American kid who grew up to be who became the president of the senior class at my high school and is now the mayor of Alexandria, Virginia. Mm. And you look at a guy like Bill Yule and you look at Barack Obama, and you think, problem solved. Not.
Would that it
Why was not? So. Yeah. Why not? Because a lot of people saw Barack Obama's election as the end of this conversation.
You know, look, the fact that we have been so quick, some, mm-hmm. to jump to that is, I think, very telling. And it takes about 20 seconds to dispel the logic of it, because if you just think for a minute, you know, if I were to say, and I say this in my talks and in my writing as well, if I were to tell you that women and girls in Pakistan have fully equal opportunity, and this I know for a fact because Benazir Bhutto, a woman, was elected not once but twice mm-hmm. as the head of state in that country. Of course, she has since been assassinated, so some people clearly were not really loving her as much as some might have claimed. But, you know, a woman was the head of state in Pakistan, in Israel, in India, in Great Britain, in the Philippines. Now, I don't think any woman, I don't even think my own, 11 and 9-year-old girls would be so naive as to think that really what they should do is pack their bags and move to Karachi, where opportunity will be equal. Like, they would know that the fact that a woman has been the head of state might be a really important thing. It's not that it's meaningless, but it doesn't mean sexism is no longer and that millions of other women have equal opportunity. So, too, the fact that we can have individual and many, not just a handful, but many incredibly successful folks of color in spite of racism doesn't have anything to do with the larger reality faced by 90 million folks. There have always been, in every system of oppression, there have been individuals who have risen. Madam C.J. Walker was the first black millionaire in this country. She became a millionaire in 1911 because she manufactured and distributed beauty products, cosmetics that white cosmetic firms didn't feel the need to make or distribute. So good for her. But no one in their right mind, I hope, would have said in 1911, which on balance was not a good year to be black in this country, well, why can't you just go out like Madam C.J. and make $1 million? You know, there were 67 black folks lynched that year. We were a system of overt formal apartheid, and yet there were individuals like her who were able to succeed. That says nothing about the systemic truth. So we can both celebrate, you know, the individual accomplishments. I'm not going to say that it means nothing that Barack Obama's president. John Lewis tells me it does, and I'm in no position to question him on the matter. But if we take that individual accomplishment as a substitute for systemic change, then I think we're missing a much, much bigger
picture. Well, I just said that we all – many people, not we mm-hmm. all, but many people believe that the election of Barack Obama, a watershed moment, no question about it, in American history, was the end of the conversation. We had solved the problem. Now we can move on in a post-racial society. And now it turns out, as you look at what's been the conversation, the political conversation that we've been having the last 4 years – that it's far from the end of the conversation. In fact, it has caused things to percolate to the surface because a lot of the things that are being said about the president are racially based, are they not?
I think that they really are. And I think that we've actually we've only begun to wrestle with the notions of race in America. I don't think that we've begun to deal with the extent to which we have built this infrastructure to support this racist system that's in place. We have, if you think about the fact that we've been, quote unquote, moving beyond race since the civil rights movement, let's say, mm-hmm. We've only a few years, 50 years, 60 years, where we're starting to move beyond, quote unquote, overt racism in a legal sense, but we've never dismantled the ideology that undergird this. We've never dismantled the theological ideologies that undergird this.
Meaning what?
The way that we read Scripture, Genesis chapter 9, the curse of Ham or Canaan, is one of the most abused passages in all of Scripture. And the way that this has been used and still influences the way that we read text today is significant. I think the way that we handle Scripture, the way that we handle theology, and the way that we handle ideology needs to be addressed before we can even begin to say that we're moving beyond, quote-unquote, a racialized world.
When Tim Wise was talking about walking down the street and you're approaching a white guy and you don't see danger, even though he might be deranged and carrying a collision, Kalashnikov under his trench coat, yes. But if it's a black guy, flags go up.
Yes.
Is it the Bible? Does it go back to Ham that when we see a black person, danger, white person, no danger?
I don't know if it goes back to the Bible. I think it's been read into the Bible. I think the way that we have read text, the way that we have read our society, and the way that we've read blackness in our society has all contributed to a overt system where race is problematized, where blackness is problematized. And we really need to address this. We really need to have an open conversation that begins to seriously dismantle, deconstruct this concept in our society.
Do we need to have that conversation? Because in 40 years or 50 years, white people are going to be in the minority.
Yes.
So we'll be on the other end of the stick, so
well,
to speak.
So, except, you know, this is the thing we need to remember is that a distinct minority of white folks in South Africa, only about 6 or 7% of the population there, was able to hold on to a disproportionate share of power for an incredibly long time. I think if 7% of white South Africans can pull that off, probably 45% of white Americans can also do that. So my fear is that just, you know, this idea that just because white folks will no longer be the absolute majority, we actually will remain the plurality. We're still going to be the largest single group.
And have the money.
And have a disproportionate share mm-hmm. of the wealth. Right now, the typical black family has the typical white family has 20 times the net worth of the typical black family, 18 times that of the typical Latino family. So the numbers may change demographically, but if anything, that means we really have to have this conversation, because if we get to a point in 30 or 40 years where we're a 50-50 country, let's say 50% folks of color, 50% white, and we still have the 20-to-1 wealth disparity, the 3 times greater poverty rate, 2 times greater unemployment rate, 9 years less life expectancy for black and Latino folks, that's not a recipe for a functional society. That's actually going to hurt everyone. So if anything, that change that's coming makes this conversation all the more necessary, makes it more critical that we reduce those disparities than even 10 or 20 years ago.
But how do you change that? It seems to me that power begets power, and them that's got gets more. If your money makes money. If you have a lot of money, and it's going to make more money for you. And if you have no money, it's hard just to get by.
Exactly.
How do you change that equation in a capitalist democratic society?
Well, we have laws and monetary and fiscal and tax policy that help make that even more true than it should be. I mean, we favor wealth over earned income. So, I mean, the fact that people with money, for instance, who make their money from – who get their income from capital gains pay a reduced tax rate relative to those who go out and work, shining shoes or working at the grocery store or working out at TSA folks at the airport. So if you make your money through earned income like most of us do, you know, you pay a higher rate. If you make your money from the money you already own and the property and stuff you already own, then you pay a lower rate, which means we have a tax code that actually favors the wealthy who are disproportionately white because of this history. And we don't think of that as racial. We don't think of capital gains tax cuts as a race-based policy because it's not necessarily deliberate, but the effect of that, the effect of favoring certain types of investment income over other types of investment income, the fact that we subsidize homeownership for upper middle class families with huge tax deductions, which I benefit from, I'm not going to say that I don't, but yet we think of any type of public housing subsidy as welfare, and yet we give out 10 times more, hundreds of times more is lost to the Treasury because of the subsidizing of upper middle class homes through the tax code. Those are policies that we have, and those are policies that we can alter if we want to.
Proponents of that policy would tell you, or would say, I think some of them would say, that, well, it's because those people are poor because they don't want to work.
Well, and that's ultimately what people believe. I mean, there's no question.
And that's not true in all cases.
It's hardly ever true. You know, most of the people who will say that themselves haven't spent a whole lot of time sitting in the living rooms of desperately poor people and listening to them talk about their hopes and their dreams and their fears for their kids. And I've done that. I've sat in those living rooms and I've met some of the hardest working people that I ever knew, far harder working than myself, who lived in public housing. They worked every single day. And I mean, at a paid job and also at home trying to keep, you know, their kids from getting in trouble, trying to keep a roof over their head. And one woman in particular who I worked with in New Orleans, she worked at the nonprofit group that I worked for, and she was the office manager. And one weekend, her son was murdered. And the very next day after that, she came to work. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, you know, we all were thinking, really, you should take some time off. You know, your child was killed. And I, you know, there were days that I called out because I had a headache or I'd been out partying or I just didn't feel like coming in. And here was this woman who everybody would say, because she lived in public housing, because she was poor, because she was a quote unquote welfare recipient, was somehow lazy. And she was working harder, more dedicated to her job than, frankly, those of us with college degrees. So I think a lot of that stereotyping, a lot of the scapegoating that we do needs to be rethought.
In your book, you write about the legacy of white privilege built up over generations. It's hard to stop that because it's wealth, it's other things as well. It's social connections, networking, good old boy network, and not even the good old boy network, just the fact that you went to the same school with some guy, suddenly that gives you a leg up on a job.
Yeah.
That would mean to me that there's the reverse side of that is a legacy of underprivilegedness, if that's a word.
Disadvantagedness
that has built up over generations, which is equally hard to break, it seems to me.
It is. It's really hard to think about going to school to advance your life if you've never seen anyone who went to high school and graduated, who went to college and graduated. If you don't know how to make a college application, how do you begin to do that? If you don't even know when it's time to apply for the SATs.
Right.
It's a significant thing to try to move yourself from a situation where you've been disadvantaged your entire life.
I have an educator here, Thomas Franz, headmaster at the Trinity Episcopal School. Talk to me about this problem, because a lot of people look at this and say, look, in America, we have free public education through high school, and lots of people get into college and go for 4 years for free as well, particularly if you work hard and apply yourself. So if you waste your education, if you waste the first through eighth grade or your high school years, too bad for you.
Well, yeah, I don't think we're going to be able to solve the education problem here because I do think it's very much socioeconomic and racial, and it's an incredibly complex world out there, which is one of the reasons why it's a whole lot easier to be the head of an independent school where we get to do what we want to do. But I would say that part of the challenge we have in America today is the messaging about all of these things, the messages that come from whites and the messages that come from blacks. So many of the very people who are trying to help in schools that are disadvantaged will quote statistics and data about how horrible it is to be in this racial and ethnic group in this socioeconomic class that then the media spreads widely, and they're really using data because they're looking for dollars to fund their program, which they need from the government and other nonprofit organizations, but it actually tends to support the myth that we might have created around certain groups of people in our society. And I think that's part, you know, Tim mentions the whole welfare state and who really qualifies as a welfare recipient, and a lot of us do, but that's not typically the message that we see in the media from white media or any group. And so it's really troublesome. We watched the movie Hoodwinked a couple weeks ago as a faculty and talked about this very fact of the statistics out there aren't always presented that are real. When we talk about school dropouts and what does that really look like for, you know, African-American males and the data that's out there, if you go just even to historically black colleges and universities and say what percentage of the kids at this school are African-Americans, the African-Americans at the school will say it's a hugely small number when it actually isn't. So I think part of it's the messaging that we've created in part to help the very people that need the assistance, but the messages have really been negative for them over the years.
Speaking of messages, when we come back from the break, we'll share some messages that have come in while we've been talking, and I'll open the phones to a couple of people who have been holding on with, I think, cogent comments. We're going to come right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Sports.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Levine Cancer Institute, part of Carolina's healthcare system, offering hope to those battling cancer by focusing on advances in cancer prevention, detection, diagnosis, and treatment. Details at 980-442-2000. New York lawmakers agree on tighter gun control laws. President Obama is expected to announce broad action to curb gun violence this week. An update on federal and state gun control efforts on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like information on Tim Wise's appearances while he's in Charlotte, you can get that on our website right now at WFAE.org. And you can also go to WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks to participate or call us 704-926-WFAE or 800-603-WFAE. We're coming right back.
Facing doping allegations, Lance Armstrong had a tough relationship with sports reporters.
It is very telling, I think, that when he ultimately decides to come clean, he does it with someone who's not from that world.
Oprah Winfrey, Lance Armstrong, and the Fallen Cyclist's media strategy today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. A conversation on race with Tim Wise, author, activist, and author of White Like Me, Reflections on Race from a Privileged Son, also Affirmative Action, Racial Preference in Black and White. Reverend Dr. Rodney Sadler from Mecklenburg Ministries and Mount Carmel Baptist, and Thomas Franz, headmaster of Trinity Episcopal School. Let's take a couple of phone calls. We'll begin in Mooresville. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael, and your guests. Good morning. I'm going to give you an example of what happened to me New Year's Eve. If you don't think racism is alive and well, I'm going to give you this, and then I'm going to tell you how ashamed I was of myself. I'm at a New Year's party, and I'm with people I don't know, and across the table from me is an attractive 5 foot, 110-pound woman who was telling about working in an athletic office at a local college, and that this 7 foot recruited black man came into her office, okay, and I could hear the way black came out of her mouth. And she said he sat across from her, and she felt very uncomfortable. And what my mind said to me was, well, wouldn't you, as a tiny little woman, felt uncomfortable being a 7 foot white guy? And I didn't call her out on it because I didn't know the woman. There wasn't any point. But to me, it was so blatantly racist, this 7 foot black guy was sitting across from her, and I didn't call her out. And actually, I'm just kind of ashamed that I wanted to say, well, you know, you're tiny, and this, if a 7 foot guy is across from you, don't you feel a little bit intimidated? Not a fear factor, but a little bit intimidated.
Well, let's talk about, because this is a conversation about race, and people have called for conversations about race in the society at large, and this is an example of where a conversation could have begun or ended very quickly, it seems to me. So how do you handle a situation like that?
Well, you know, first of all, I think it's really important that we forgive ourselves in those moments where we drop the ball, because we're all going to do that. And whether or not the caller really dropped the ball on that one, you know, who knows? The reality is that in all likelihood, whatever conversation he could have prompted in that moment probably would not have become this deep, amazing discourse, because she probably wouldn't have been open to it if indeed she was coming from the place that he suspects. But maybe, you know, maybe there'll be another opportunity. I'm sure there will be. There are plenty of times. I mean, I do this for a living. I do this all the time, and I've done it professionally for over 20 years, but there are times when I find myself caught completely flat-footed. Someone says something so out of the blue that you don't expect, because, you know, it's just out of context. You know, you'd be sitting there talking, all of a sudden someone says something that you think, wow, was that racist or was that sexist or was that whatever? And you're just so caught off guard that you don't know what to do, but you have to. What advice I would give is, we know those moments are coming. So the best thing that we can do is try to think in our own head ahead of time, sort of prepare ourselves for, you know, when this thing happens, and I know it's gonna, here's what I'm gonna do. And the more prepared you are, I've practiced literally how I'm gonna respond to jokes or comments or things like that. And it doesn't mean you get it right all the time, but it gets you a little bit more prepared, I think.
Dennis, thank you for your call. There's a song in a Broadway show called Avenue Q. Have you all seen it?
Mm-hmm.
Puppets do all the talking, and puppets can say things and do things that real people can't say or do. And the song is called Everybody's a Little Bit Racist.
Mm, right.
In their own way. Blacks may look at Asians funny. we look at blacks funny. Asians may look at Hispanics funny, etc. Do you think that's true?
I think everyone's a bit prejudiced, and we could work with this notion of prejudice. I think the concept of racism is often misconstrued as just having a bias against another race. I think the notion of racism really does involve the notion of having a certain amount of power in society over other groups. So I just would be careful with the way that we use that term, racism. Racism really does involve the ability to force your ideas on other people, to define other people, and to have that sort of position in society. I love the way that you've analyzed, Tim, in your book, the notion of what's going on in Bermuda, mm-hmm. to talk about even when blacks are in the majority, they still aren't able to dictate the terms right. in which people live in society. So I'd worry about the term racism, but I think that you're 100% right when you talk about the notion of prejudice. This prejudice does seem to be pervasive, and we always tend to seem to favor ourselves and those like us over those who are different from us.
Well, that's one of the reasons you wrote your book. I mean, your book title, White Like Me, is kind of a twist on the title of John Howard Griffin's book, Black Like Me. It's written by a white guy who dyed his skin chemically and went to the South in 1959 and lived as a black guy and then wrote about it. Right. And you say the difference is that he wrote about the differences. Let me get this right. That he made white people think about race from the perspective of what it meant to be something that they weren't. Right. And you're writing about what it means to be us, what we are.
Right. I mean, I think there was real value in Griffin's work at the time. It was revolutionary in 1960 and 61 when it was released and when they made a film of it later. Because really, you know, white folks had that luxury of completely ignoring actual black people who had written the equivalent of Black Like Me all their lives. I mean, Zora Neale Hurston had written 7 of those, and James Baldwin had written 15 of those, and Richard Wright. I mean, they'd all written the equivalent of Black Like Me, but it took a white guy, I guess, in 1959, 60, 61, to open white folks' eyes to what that experience really was. And my feeling was, you know, 40 years later or so, that it was just time. It was way past time for those of us who were white, not just to voyeuristically try to figure out what does it mean to be black. Because, I mean, there's value in that, but I don't need to listen to a white person tell me that. I can listen to actual black people. But what I need to do is get clear on what it means to be exactly who I am. Same thing with being a man. I need to, if I'm going to really understand sexism and what my daughters face and what my wife faces and what, you know, my mom has faced, I can try to understand what it means to be a woman, but I'm only going to get that sort of secondhand. Whereas if I really sit and think about what does it mean to be a man in a male-dominated society and get clear on that, I'm going to have a better understanding of their experience, just like if I think about what it means to be white, what it means to be, you know, economically comfortable now. I wasn't growing up, but I am now. What it means to be able-bodied, what it means to be straight, what it means to be a member of all these different dominant groups, that has meaning. And the thing about privilege, those of us who have it, and by the way, I want to make real clear for the listeners, everyone just about has some of it. Like, there are very few people you're going to find who don't have any privilege at all. They may be a person of color, but they may be straight, or they may be able-bodied, or they may be, you know, college educated. So everyone's got some. And when you have some privilege, whether it's race, gender, class, sexuality, religion, physical ability, it's real easy to miss that. It's real easy to only see the times that you're down. So for those of us who are white but maybe grew up without money, which was the case for me, it's real easy for us to say, well, I didn't have privilege because I didn't have any money. Well, that's – I didn't have class privilege, but there's this other thing that many times trumped that. I was still treated like a smart kid in school, even, you know, even though
– well, and when you and I grew up in the 50s and 60s, it was a very different society than it is today. Is the same true for kids growing up today who happen to be white? Are they – even if they're poor, are they still more privileged than – middle-class African-Americans?
Well, the evidence certainly says that, yes. I mean, for instance, we know that even white poor kids are more likely to go to middle-class schools where the majority of the students are middle-class and above. Affluent, upper-middle-class black kids are 2 to 3 times more likely to attend a majority poverty school than white poor kids are. So, in fact, there are some real institutional advantages. We know that white kids who are poor are still less likely to be suspended or expelled from school than black kids who are upper-middle-class, even though they don't behave at any different rates. You know, there's still a differential treatment. When the teacher sees that white kid, even if they're working-class, acting up, there's a different interpretation of that, just as there is in the justice system. So it's not to deny the economic pain that millions of white folks are in, especially right now. It is to say that in spite of that, there is still this other thing that we have to be aware of.
George in Charlotte, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
Thank you, Mike. Long-time fan of your show.
Thank you.
Glad to be on. My question is for your talkers today is, what they think about this issue of racism, especially, you know, you use that question about a black man walking down the street towards you and us being scared, if that is more of an instinctual, possibly biologic response to someone we perceive not to be of our own tribe, basically a leftover evolutionary defense mechanism. You know, and you asked the question of maybe this comes from that verse in Genesis, you know, but at the same time, when I walk through the woods and I see a snake, I don't think that that's the incarnation of the devil. I see a wild animal that might bite me, even though it's probably a harmless snake. Mm-hmm. You understand my question
yeah.
here?
I would just say that the difference is when you see a hyena or a wild snake, this is a species that's different from yourself. And so it makes perfect sense to think, wow, I don't know what this thing's going to do. Like, I don't know when it's giving off clues that it's dangerous. But when you see another member of the human family, there ought to be at least enough clues that we as adults can read to know if that person is really agitated. If they're really agitated and acting dangerous, then it's one thing. You know, we definitely have a racialized, non-biologic response because we don't necessarily respond the same way to we have that response with black folks, maybe not with Asian folks. We have that response with certain groups and not others. And I think although certainly the process of othering is that is probably hardwired in us. We do that when we see people who are different. But we have a society that has told us year after year after year that these people are dangerous. And so when I see a white man driving around in a Lexus, even though he could be an insider trader who's, you know, selling Wall Street derivatives and wrecking the economy and responsible for far more damage than all the black and brown street thugs combined, but I'm not going to be as afraid of the white guy in the Lexus in spite of the power that he has and the damage that he can do as I am a black kid in a hoodie or for that matter, a black adult in a hoodie. And that's the social conditioning piece.
Thanks, George, for your call. A question from TT via email. Why do you think the president, the most powerful man in the country, has not made race relations a primary issue during his presidency? And question number two, your conversation in the first half hour has sounded to me to say white people have the problem with race relations and the issue is not two-sided. Can you please address that? So let's begin with the president.
I think it's very difficult to be the first African-American president of the United States and to put the burden of dealing with the whole race issue on this one man because of his own inherent color is, I think, a problematic notion. Why didn't George Bush do it?
And the other question with regard to President Obama is, his mother was white. Why is he the first black president?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. And if you think about notions of race in America – African Americans have always been a mixed, quote unquote, race issue. In my scholarship, I don't use the term race without quotation marks because I think it's a fictive category. Mm-hmm. Race is something that we make up, that we put onto people. It's a social construct that we ascribe to people. But African Americans have always been mixed race. White mothers, white fathers, black mothers, black fathers, Native American. This has always been a hodgepodge. Black does not really mean of African descent. It means African and. It's an admixed category. So I think that Barack Obama is just as black as many other people and far more black than many people that we would ascribe to the category of black without qualification.
And what about the second question, that the problem is strictly a white problem and not a mixed problem?
Well, you know, from an educator's perspective, it's everybody's problem, and that's part of why I think it's really important for children to have courageous conversations, important hard conversations, be exposed to people different from them, and not just around race. So part of what we try to do is put kids in situations through service learning, working with kids that have cognitive difficulties, physical impairments, some of the things that Tim mentioned that are outside of typically the race box, to really develop cultural dexterity for children so that they are perhaps not comfortable with everybody because they haven't had experience with everybody, but they're interested and open about other people more broadly. And right. I don't think it's just one-sided.
Well, and the reason I would say maybe it is a white problem, at least in a sense, is that those of us who are white we're the ones who have the luxury of not thinking about this. So therefore, the reason I make it a quote-unquote white issue is really twofold. Number one, people of color tend to know race is in the room. They tend to know race is an issue. It's because when you're the dominant group, you do have the luxury of ignoring it. So I think sexism is a male issue for that reason. Having said that, it's also really important for those of us who are white, I think. You know, it's funny. Conservatives always talk about, you know, those folks need to take personal responsibility for themselves. Well, that's what I'm doing. When I talk about whiteness and white privilege, I'm trying to own my piece of it. I, you know, for me to not talk about whiteness or for me to say, well, it's 50-50 is sort of to shirk the personal responsibility that I think I need to be taking. So, yeah, black and brown folks got to have a whole different conversation amongst themselves, and they do. Black and brown folks have got issues in their community they got to deal with, and I'm just saying let me deal with my piece, which is this white piece, you know.
Charlotte, Aaron in Charlotte writes, I'm a biracial woman, mm-hmm. also known as a mulatto. And I am currently writing a book on the issues mulattoes are forced to deal with in their lifetime, one being because we are fairer in complexion and have, quote, good hair, unquote. It seems biracial children have a little more privilege than darker blacks. Mm-hmm. Mulattoes are also taught to deny their white blood from blacks. What connection do you see there to what we're talking about today?
I think that there's. I think in part what she's getting at is there's a notion of internal racial problems in the African American community.
The high yellow.
The paper bag test. This sort of notion of good hair, good and bad hair, which is there's a wonderful song in what is that Spike Lee movie? School Days.
Yeah.
So there's these wonderful images out there, but. Brian Bantam, let me suggest that you take a look at Brian Bantam's work on this notion. He does a good deal of work trying to wrestle with this. What does it mean to be biracial in America? There's a great deal that needs to be done within the African-American community to start to recover from the notion of race and racism. How do we begin to wrestle with what we have done to ourselves as well? Because the ideology is pervasive, and it is not just something that comes at us from white people from the outside. It's something that we have bought into to a certain extent, yeah. even in unconscious ways, and perpetuate.
We've had 300 to 400 years of slavery in this country. Then we had Jim Crow. Then we've had a mere 50 years of at least legal equality, if not in practice. So how long will it take? And the conversation on racism has not even begun. So how long will this take? Another 100 years?
Well, if everybody would start to buy into programs like Soul to Soul, Souls of White Folks, and begin to engage.
That's a program that you guys run.
That's a program that Mecklenburg Ministries has put in place that begins to take a look at white privilege and take it seriously, that begins to look at race and racial difference. If people would begin to engage in programs like this, Friday Friends program, where you actually sit down with someone who's different and have these conversations, we're at a place where we can begin to start to address this issue.
Reverend Dr. Rodney Sadler, board member of Mecklenburg Ministries, pastor of Mount Carmel Baptist Church.
Not pastor of Mount Carmel.
Oh.
Associate minister.
Associate Minister.
Casey Kimbrough's pastor.
And Thomas Franz, who I believe is the headmaster of Trinity Episcopal.
You got that right.
And Tim Wise, author of White Like Me, Reflections on Race from a Privileged Son. Thank you for the hour.